Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for tuning in once again as we continue just digging right through our big old monster box of 5,000 baseball cards, primarily from the 1980s, but as you'll find out, we've got some from the early 90s. Everyone enjoying the conversations we've had over the last few weeks, and we'll have a conversation with our listeners via our check-in at the Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. We'll do that in a moment. But on this episode, we'll be talking about 88 Fleer, a departure from the Fleer sets of much of the 1980s, and our random pull card number 78, Will the Thrill Clark. This was one of the most exciting guys to play the game at that time, and he had a heck of a career. We'll talk about that in just a little bit, not just with San Francisco, but basically anywhere Rafael Palmeiro played, Will Clark was right there behind Rafi. It is stunning how many times in his career Palmeiro comes in, Palmeiro goes out, Clark comes in. But regardless, the fact that Palmeiro's shadow tended to be Will Clark for much of his career, of course, they were former teammates at Mississippi State, still Will Clark with a tremendous career and really one of the more exciting players and who played on some pretty exciting teams throughout his career. So we'll talk about that in just a little bit. Also want to remind you that we are looking for sponsors for the Wax Ecstatic podcast. It comes out twice a week, Tuesdays and Fridays, via Audio Boom. Hopefully soon we'll be on iTunes, and we're getting some requests for Stitcher, so we'll see if we can make that connection up there. But we're trying to spread the program around. It's grown a lot over the last few weeks, so if you own a company or you know somebody who owns a company who would like to reach out to our listeners, chances are the customers you're looking for, they're just like you. If you're listening to this podcast, you like the content and you're very like-minded to the other people who are listening. So if you have any interest in advertising, or like I said, you know somebody who does, reach out to me. Just DM us. I follow most of our followers, so DM us, let us know what you're looking at, and we'll have a conversation just to see if we can make a fit. Now, let's have our conversation with our listeners at Wax and Gum Stains, our Twitter feed. As always, please pass along the word about not only the podcast, again, coming out Tuesdays and Fridays on Audio Boom, but also about our Twitter feed as we encourage hobby collecting conversations left and right. You've got questions. You've got thoughts about the hobby. You want to just put up pictures of your favorite cards or card collections. If you want to comment about any of our podcasts, you're more than welcome to, again, at Wax and Gum Stains. Now, our last podcast was on the very unpopular, and I believe wrongly so, 88 Donruss set. And really, the 88 Donruss set, it's so unpopular because there's still about 80 billion of those cards just floating around the planet Earth right now. It's a very nice card. It's got some star power, got some good rookies. In fact, some great rookies. You look at guys like Tom Glavin and Roberto Alomar. I mean, you've got some real star power in that set. But a lot of collectors to this day look down on the set. Well, I tried to give it a little bit of a break in our last podcast, and I've got plenty of other people who feel the same way that I do, including Sports Carter checking in. I'm a fan of 88 Donruss. I'm probably in the minority, but I really like the borders. Well, Sports Carter, you're not in the minority. Well, maybe you're in the minority of the general card collecting public, if you will. But I think a lot of listeners to our podcast actually really like the 88 Donruss set. Now, you like it for the borders. I think that's what made the design rather unique, even though it wasn't a state-of-the-art design. I mentioned in that podcast, it didn't exactly have a 1988 feel, certainly had a 1978 feel. There was kind of a disco dance floor look to it, but I thought it was kind of a cool design. And again, cool in the figurative language as well, in that the feeling of cool is typically related to the color blue, a dark blue, and that was evident throughout the front and back of the 88 Donruss set. So you're not the only one, Sports Carter. In fact, we had quite a few people talking about 88 Donruss. Jason Carter asking us, how about 88 Donruss Baseball's Best, the Halloween set? Yes, Baseball's Best. And Donruss would do this. They would take their template for their card, their base set, and they typically just change the main color of the certainly the front border, but also the back of the cards. One set that comes to mind, the 1991 Rookies set. If you remember, the 1991 Donruss set, Series 1 had a blue border, Series 2 had a green border, and the Rookies set had a red border, and the back was kind of this weird lime green color. I remember that. So the Best of Baseball, or Baseball's Best, excuse me, the set from 1988 took the exact same design that the base set had, but instead of the blue, black, and, you know, a little touch of red that the base set had, it was orange and black throughout the Baseball's Best set. And yeah, if you line up the squares perfectly, you've got a whole bunch of goofy looking jack-o'-lanterns looking back at you. Jason also chiming in a conversation that Peter Steinberg started up. And let's see, Peter Steinberg, first of all, started with, in your discussions of score baseball card colors, and this is going back to podcast, it makes me think their schemes are the Miami Vice of cards. Well, yeah, there is a little bit of a Crockett and Tubbs feel to it, but I don't think 88 score is the set that is really Miami Vice. 91 score definitely is. There was some teal and some dark blue, although I don't even think Miami Vice was still on TV in 91. Maybe I'm wrong. But I still think the 88 score set was the Skittles set. There was definitely a rainbow effect of all the colors. But, you know, if Crockett and Tubbs wanted to get wild and put on some more primary colors as opposed to pastels like they did often in the TV show, then I think it kind of fits the bill. Ben Adams, when talking about the 88 Donruss set, I agree with you 100% that this set gets overlooked due to overproduction. And that is a theme that you're going to see through a lot of the sets from, you know, pretty much, I mean, it really started in 1987 when the card company started cranking out cards left and right. But definitely 1988 because you had Score come in, so there's your fourth card company. And because the hobby got so popular and there was so much money involved in the hobby, there was just so many cards. And even though some really nice cards were produced during this time, because here we are 25, 30 years later, there's still so many of them out there. You know, people looking for cash value in terms of I can buy something low and sell it back high in a few years. You're not going to find that in much of these sets. Now, you do have some exceptions. You have noteworthy players like Barry Bonds and Mark McGwire and Jose Canseco. And then you have the Hall of Fame-worthy players or players who have gotten into the Hall of Fame, I guess I should say. You know, your Ken Griffey Juniors, your Cal Ripkins, you know, guys like that. You know, you're going to see, certain cards will rise above others in terms of value. But you look at a top set, 792 cards from, let's say, 1988, you know, there's really just maybe five or six cards that are worth more than a dollar, and that's unfortunate. But I think there's some really quality sets, like 89 tops I like, 90 Fleer I like, 91 tops I like. You look at some of the Stadium Club cards, you know, some of the Upper Deck cards that came out over the years. There were some really nice sets that came out, but because they were so overproduced and there's so many still out there, and for the people who are simply, again, looking to, you know, buy low and sell high, there's not much interest in that from these particular sets. Some really nice sets just kind of get kicked to the curb, and that's unfortunate. But that's also one of the reasons why we're doing this podcast, because we're not only drumming up some childhood memories of the cards that you and I collected way back when, but you get a second look at some of these sets. And I guarantee you, probably 20-30% of the audience that's listening to this, they went back, found some 88 Donruss cards, and looked at them and said, you know what? Matt's right. They're not that bad. In fact, you know, let me shuffle through here. Oh, hey, look, I found, an extra Mark McGwire card. And, well, maybe I should actually put these Tom Glavine cards in little plastic sleeves and not just leave them in this cardboard box. So I would like to give some sets that have not really been given their due another round of a second look-see to where people go, you know what, that wasn't so bad. And I'm gonna surprise some people with some of my picks. I think there are some sets that just get totally stomped on because of overproduction, because maybe they weren't as great as another set that year. But I think if you take a second look at them, you'll go, you know what, that's not that far off. That actually is a decent card. That's a decent set. And speaking of decent cards and decent sets, our set this week, the 88 Fleer set. One more comment from Peter Steinberg. Boy, we had a handful of people really driving the conversation this week. Again, you can join us at Wax and Gum Stains with your comments. Peter, when responding to a tweet promoting this podcast, the 88 Fleer set, Peter says, "Don't know if this is a popular set or not, but I quite like this design, and not for any political reasons. Feels clean." Now, what's the political commentary about? Well, I mentioned that the 88 Fleer set looks an awful lot like an election year set. And it was. 1988 was an election year. And there's an awful lot of red, white, and blue going on in the 88 Fleer set. As we take a look at our random pull, again, card number 78, talk about star power. We've been able to pull some big names in the last few shows here. But Will Clark, you look at the card, and you know what, Peter? There is an element of clean. There's an element of politics. There's an element of what the hell was Fleer doing? There's a little bit of all of that going on in this card here. When we look at the, you look at the front of the card. Let's first of all look at something that was happening in the 87 Fleer set that you see continued in the 88 Fleer set, and you will see, despite the red, white, and blue stripes all around the top, bottom, and side, you know, really the true border of the card, you have the player's picture, and in this case it's Will Clark in the on deck circle about to apply a whopping amount of pine tar on his bat. So, you know, it's a pretty good shot of him about to, you know, contemplate what he's going to be doing with this lumber and what he's going to be doing in this upcoming at bat. But much like 87 Fleer had this really unique 3D approach, you know, Kent Tekulve was the random pull in that set. And even though he was just sitting there posing for a shot, the way that Fleer laid things out, he kind of leapt out at you just a little bit. They try to do the same thing in the 88 set, where if you look at the background of the picture, it fades to white, so it blends in with the white background in the border. So it, again, has that 3D feel to it, but doesn't quite work as well. And I think it's because there's contrast, you know, with Kent Tekulve, and there were plenty of other cards in the 87 Fleer set. The way that they were able to position the pictures against that light blue background, there was contrast. It kind of, you know, just naturally, your eyes had to read it as this was jumping out at you. This doesn't jump out at you. It blends. Now, that is part of the clean part there. I think the picture does blend in real well. I think it blends in with the other aspects of the card, including the player's name and position in the upper left-hand corner, team logo in the upper right-hand corner, Fleer not going crazy with their own logo. Nice, discreet, lower right-hand corner, small little line going across the bottom of the photo frame, if you will. So you've got that clean, very simple look there. But then you've got the election year thing going on. Red, white, and blue. It's everywhere. And for Fleer, this is a big change in direction. Let's go back through the mid-80s sets. I called 83 Fleer the business set. I called 84 Fleer the business with a silk tie set. The 85 Fleer set was the business with a cardigan sweater set. The 86 Fleer set was the casual Friday Fleer set there. The 87 Fleer set was the company picnic business set. The 88 Fleer set, in my opinion, is you just told the boss to take this job and shove it. This is the weekend bender. We're going to have a party. There's stripes everywhere. There's streamers everywhere. And we're just going to, you know, this was the 180. Okay, we've been business all these years. Screw it. We're going to have some fun. And I think that's what Fleer tried to do, but it comes off awkwardly here. In fact, if you don't even think about the picture blending in with the background, you look at these cards and you think, you know what? If somebody could fart confetti, this is what it would look like. I mean, really, there is a windblown confetti effect going on here. Or an American Airlines advertisement. You know, it tries to be fun, but it's not. It's the awkward kid at the party. Remember those parties you went to maybe in junior high school, maybe even college? But especially in junior high and high school, you've got the cliques. You've got the popular people and then everybody else. And you're at that party and you see the class nerd drinking a beer at the party. Like, what's he doing here? That's what 88 Fleer is doing. After years of all of these very business, nice, clean, straight-edge sets, all of a sudden, I'm pounding a PBR. It's Fleer 1988. I mean, that's what you got going on here. So it works. It's clean, but it's a little awkward. And that's just, you know, I don't know. You know, I'm mixed about this set. I'm not in love with the design as much as the 88 Donruss set, you know, if we're comparing 1988 sets right now. I don't think design-wise it's as good as Donruss or Score was that year. But I also think it's not as bad as 88 Tops. I was never a fan of 88 Tops, and we'll talk about that in our next podcast. But, you know, 88 Fleer is kind of sort of just somewhere in the middle. And as Peter mentioned, he said, I don't know if this is a popular set or not. I don't either, Peter. I really think that when you look at 88 Fleer, and we're just on the front half, we'll get to the back side of the card, which is actually pretty neat in just a little bit. This is a card set that is not universally loved, but it's also not universally hated. If there's a stack of 88 Fleer packs in front of you, you wouldn't be offended to spend a few dollars to buy them. But you're not going to go out of your way to buy a whole bunch of 88 Fleer cards. And it's not just because of overproduction. It's just a set that doesn't really wow you. It doesn't grab you. It's good, but it's certainly not great. But it's not bad. You know, it's really in the mushy middle of baseball cards, and certainly in the 1988 sets that came out. All right, let's flip the card over, and we've got a picture of the back of the card. Again, card number 78, the card number in the upper right-hand corner, the player name and personal information in the upper left-hand corner, and then true to Fleer fashion, you've got the vertical stripes going down. This year, they went with this dark blue and white background, dark blue text. And at the bottom, you know, I mentioned this in the 87 set, they started having some fun with statistics, you know, kind of infographics, which are big now. You know, Fleer was doing it in the late 80s. In many ways, they were so far ahead of the curve with telling stories. And in the 88 series, you could see here in the Will Clark card, it says at their best, and it broke down, you know, it gave splits to his numbers, how he hit in the daytime, in the nighttime, at home, on the road. It was batting average, slugging percentage, and on base average. And of course, you had pitcher-related stats for the pitchers. And I thought this is a really neat, fun way to tell the story beyond just your typical baseball stats, which you see on the top half of the card. So again, 88 Fleer wins major brownie points, in my opinion, for telling the story that way. The colors, again, a little odd. It's almost like a photo negative of the front of the card. Not exactly. It's close. We still have the red stripes. We have this kind of light gray stripe and then the dark navy blue, which is predominant throughout the back of the card. And, you know, again, you know, the colors are just, it's a weird combination. And especially since the front is light, then you're going to this very odd back combination. Again, it's trying to be progressive. It's trying to be cool, but it is just really not coming off as cool. You know, Fleer's got the glasses with the tape, you know, holding the two lenses together. It's not quite coming off the way that we anticipated. So, you know, 88 Fleer, not bad, not great. Like I said before, the mushy middle. It is just, it's a pretty average set. Now, the good news is, if you're looking for it, as opposed to 88 Donruss, even though 88 Fleer was made in mass quantities, much like every other set during this era, not quite as massive quantities as 88 Donruss. You can still buy boxes for anywhere between $15 and $20. You can get sets for $20 to $30, depending on where you buy them. And some of the star cards and the rookies that you see in this set are valued slightly higher than what you see in Donruss. But, and I'll caution everybody who collects not only this set, but pretty much of the sets from 88 to 93. If you're looking to sell low or buy low and sell high, if you're looking to make a mint off of these cards, with very few exceptions, you're just not going to do it. So this is a set where if you're looking to collect it, you're doing it just for that reason. You're looking to collect it. You've got a hole in your 1988 collection. You've got $30 or $40 you want to spend on, you know, buying a couple boxes or buying a complete factory set. This is a good set to have. Like I said, even though it's not a great set and it's kind of, you know, a rather goofy attempt to be party-like, to be a little more fun than serious and business-like, like we'd seen in the previous, five sets that Fleer put out in the mid-80s. Even though it comes off as kind of odd and quirky, it's still not a bad set. Overall, I like it. And like I said, I wouldn't imagine anybody necessarily going out of their way for 88 Fleer. But if I offered to sell you some or give you some and say, hey, why don't you try to, put this set together, you probably wouldn't be offended. At least I wouldn't think so. It's not a set where you kind of wince at it when you look at it, but you're not going out of your way to assemble it. Now, a star card like Will Clark, I remember back in the day, this card, if you pulled it right out of the pack, it was a dollar or two. It's a little less than that nowadays. But Will Clark, the stud first baseman for much of his career, the San Francisco Giants, a couple other teams, which we'll get into in just a moment. This was one of the premier players in Major League Baseball in 1988 and for the next several seasons. And as I mentioned, he and Rafael Palmeiro pretty much just went everywhere together. They were teammates for Mississippi State. They were tremendous players back then, and Will Clark was an All-American as deemed by the Sporting News. He won the Golden Spikes Award from USA Baseball. He was the best amateur ball player in the country. And the funny thing is, Palmeiro and Clark not only kind of traveled around together, but they had already had a marketing scheme named after them when they were at Miss State. They were known as Thunder and Lightning. But that was about as close as they got. They were diametrically opposite of each other when it came to personalities and liking one another. They were good teammates, but you would not call them best friends. So it's rather ironic that, again, as Palmeiro moved on from team to team in his career, it was Will Clark who was replacing him. It was like he was always trying to one-up Rafael Palmeiro. Oh, yeah? I can play with the Texas Rangers, too. I can play with Baltimore too. Huzzah! He just kind of had that following throughout his career. Now, Clark was drafted second overall in the 1985 Major League Draft by the Giants. He made a very quick rise up into the big leagues. In fact, he made his debut April 8th, 1986. This is amazing. It's so funny. Random polls. You're talking two different players. Will Clark in this podcast. We had Jay Bell in the 88 Donruss podcast. Yet both share a very unique tidbit in their baseball careers. They both hit a home run in their first major league at bat. Told you last time, Jay Bell hitting a home run off Burt Blyleven, ironically the guy who Bell was traded for when he went from the Twins organization to Cleveland in 1985. Well, Will Clark, April 8th, 1986, the first at bat, the first pitcher he faces, just some guy named Nolan Ryan. That's all. Now, granted, Nolan Ryan, I don't ever want to say Nolan Ryan ever took a step down, because I saw him in person when he was playing for Texas in 1992. And the old man still had it then. But let's be honest, Nolan Ryan in 1986 was not Nolan Ryan in 1976. But still, it's Nolan Ryan. come on. So, Clark got his career off to a rousing start, but he got injured in the middle of the season. Still batted .287 as a rookie, but from there, it was nothing but up for Will Clark, as he had a very, very solid tenure in San Francisco. He was a five-time All-Star with the Giants. He would be an All-Star again in 1994 when he was with Texas. He was in the Rookie of the Year running in 1986, despite missing 47 games with that elbow injury. He was also in the MVP running for four of the six seasons after his rookie year. In fact, he was the runner-up in 1989. So, again, you look at his stats and compare it to other players today. Let's take a look at 1989. .333 batting average, 111 RBI, 23 home runs, 508 slugging percentage. .546 slugging percentage. I mean, this guy was a beast. But when you see today, power hitters hitting 36 home runs or 48 home runs or whatever the number, you see 23 and you're like, okay, that wasn't that bad. But this guy could whale, and he was consistent. He was dependable. He was also very good in the field. He was a Gold Glove winner in 1991 with the Giants. In 89, part of the team that made it all the way to the World Series and just got run over by that juggernaut Oakland Athletics team. And he had a really good career in San Francisco right up through 1993. Now, he was granted free agency after the 1993 season, signs as a free agent with the Texas Rangers. Again, a former team of Rafael Palmeiro, as Palmeiro moved on. So in comes Will Clark. And again, he's an all-star in his first season. It helps, too. He was able to play in the new Texas Rangers ballpark. So it was very friendly to left-handed hitters. Hit 329 that year, 13 home runs, but still a guy who would get on base a lot. Even though he was a home run hitter, this was a guy who could put the ball where the players weren't. 431 on base percentage that season. And he had several spectacular seasons with Texas, five seasons with the Rangers, including a few playoff appearances, 1996 and 1998. Remember, the Rangers up until then had never been in the playoffs, and that's dating back to their days in Washington. So since 1961, they went 30-plus years before making the postseason. He was a key part to that, along with guys like, you know, Ivan Rodriguez and Juan Gonzalez, just to name a few. But he was a star in Texas. Then in 1999, Will Clark comes to Baltimore after he was granted free agency. He signed with Baltimore about a month after the Rangers released him, signing for just under $5 million. You can actually, he was actually a pretty good bargain, even though he was a little advanced in age compared to a lot of the other players with Baltimore that season. He was 35 years old. But the time in Baltimore would be short-lived. He only played a season and a half there before he got traded to the St. Louis Cardinals, traded with cash for Jose Leon, and he was part of the Cardinals playoff run in 2000. They had a pretty good one, too. Got to the NLCS, lost to the New York Mets. Well, it wasn't Will Clark's fault that the Cardinals lost to the Mets, as Clark, in the five games that he played in, a .412 batting average. I mean, this guy, he was still going in what would turn out to be his final season. 36 years of age, still played in 130 games, had 507 plate appearances. He only hit .319, 21 home runs. I mean, this guy was still dealing right up until the very end. And he would conclude his season with the St. Louis Cardinals in 2000. Now, he was inducted into the College Baseball Hall of Fame of 2006, the Bay Area Sports Hall of Fame in 2007, and the Mississippi Sports Hall of Fame in 2008. Now, he did not get much love from the Baseball Hall of Fame voters. In fact, he only got 4.4% in his first season that he was eligible for the Baseball Hall of Fame. So because he didn't receive the 5%, that's a minimum, he was kicked off the ballot, and basically he's going to have to wait for a Veterans Committee vote at some point in time. But Will Clark, one of the, you know, it's funny how time goes on because people forget how good some of these players are. And Will Clark is definitely one of those guys who I would consider underrated. Again, he kind of gets lost in, you know, certainly from that era, you've got the Don Mattinglys and the Mark McGuires and, you know, other first basemen that stood out. And then from the more recent era, you know, Albert Pujols and, Frank Thomas, you know, all sorts of first basemen, players with bigger, gaudier numbers, they kind of overshadow consistent players. And that is what Will Clark was, consistent. Career batting average, .303, 284 home runs, 1,205 RBI, career on-base percentage of .384, a career OPS of .880, as I mentioned, constantly in the MVP race. He was in the All-Star game for many years. He was a very good fielder, a .992 fielding percentage, predominantly at first base. He did several times with his time in Texas and Baltimore play the designated hitter role. But when he was out in the field, you could count on him. And even though his career was a very good 15-year career, it's amazing that so many people kind of forget about Will Clark. And I don't know, maybe it's his personality. Maybe it's because he didn't put up the big flashy numbers, you know, like I said, 284 career home runs. But even though he didn't knock so many over the fence, I mean, here was a guy who still had over 2,000 hits. He had 440 doubles in his career. Consistent in the field, at the plate, this guy could do it. So I think over time, while we got all caught up in big flashy numbers, Unfortunately, the value that Will Clark was able to provide to the Giants, the Rangers, and then later Baltimore and St. Louis, it goes by the wayside. And that's unfortunate because I really liked Will Clark as a player. Now, there are varying stories as to Will Clark the person. He was, let's say, energetic and aggressive a lot. In fact, Jim Rome would call him Red Ass. So, you know, he had a little bit of a reputation for being high energy. Let's just leave it at that. I do recall, true story, back in, well, it had to be 1994 when he was with Texas. Back in 1994, I was in Port Charlotte. The Rangers were spring training in Port Charlotte at the time. And I have no idea how this happened. Actually, I do. I was in a Boy Scout troop that would often at least one game in spring training, you know, Tampa to Port Charlotte, it's about an hour and a half drive. We would go down to Port Charlotte and we would be the color guard for the game. And then after we did our color guard duty before the game, we would watch the game and we would watch it in this secluded area where family and friends of the ball players and team executives would watch the game. It was kind of a little, not really a berm area, but just kind of this open area along the first base stands in between the first base stands and the dugout. So it's kind of in right field foul territory. And the player parking lot was there. And somehow I ended up in the player parking lot with probably a couple hundred other people. Again, somehow general fans got back in here, and I don't think they were supposed to. And Will Clark was signing autographs. Wow, it's Will Clark. He's signing autographs. So, you know, I'm getting a baseball card out, and so are all these other people. And the crowd is just getting closer and closer and closer and closer. And Clark is handling it well. You know, he's signing things. And me just being a dumb, how old was I, 16, 17 years old, you know, I just go, hey, mosh pit. You know, I'm just goofing off. Will Clark was not thrilled about it, despite his nickname being The Thrill. As pretty much after I said that, he just handed the last item off to somebody, got in his car, and got the hell out of there. So if you were in a parking lot at the Charlotte County Sports Complex in some random spring training game in 1994, and you didn't get that Will Clark autograph because some knucklehead screamed, hey, mosh pit, my apologies. Didn't mean to drive him off. He was a red ass, and apparently he didn't want any part of a mosh pit, although that would have been quite fun, as Will Clark, being 6'2 and 190 pounds, would have been very easy to pass along in a crowd surfing event. So there you go, Will Clark, card number 78, our random pull from the 1988 Fleer set. A very good player in a kind of sort of good set. Again, it's not bad, but it never was great. And 88 Fleer, very easy to get your hands on. If you've got 30 or 40 bucks to spend, you've got a hole in your 1988 year collection. Not a bad set to get a hold of, and certainly will not set you back a lot of money, whether you buy the set whole or if you're shopping through wax packs or through individual cards. It's a very affordable set, but it's not one you should trip over your feet in trying to acquire. Now, speaking of not good sets, the 1988 top set. That is our next podcast subject. We'll do a random poll. I'm trying to like 88 tops. I'm trying. All these years later, I'm trying. But I just can't seem to do it. There might be a good reason why. I'll explain in our next podcast. It's coming on Tuesday. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for listening to Wax Ecstatic.